Okay, so what is the verse today?
Chapter 2nd.
Text number 2. But I will, Veta will come at a certain point.
Advaita Prabhu.
Yes.
Would you like us to wait for you before we start?
Okay, Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1st, Chapter 10, Text Number 2. Narayanam Namaskritya Naram Chaiva Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato Jayam Udirayet Nashta Praesha Bhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naistiki Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Sutovacha. Vamsham Kuro Vamshadavagni Niritam Samrohahitva Bhava Pavana Hari Niveshayitva Nijaraje Ishvara Yudhishthiram Pritamana Babuva Babuvaha Sutovacha Vamshankuro Vamshadavakni Niritam Samroha hitva bhavano bhavano hari Nivesha hitva nijaraja ishvaro Yudhishthiram pritamana babuvaha Sotovacha Vamsham kuror vamshadavagni nirritam Samrohaitva bhava bhavano hari Niveshaitva nijaraja ishvaro Yudhishthiram Pritamanam Babuvaha Sutovacha Vamshankuror Vamshadavagni Niritam Samrohitva Bhava Bhavano Hari Nivesha itva nijaraja ishvaro Yudhishthiram pritamana babuvaha Sotavacha
Nideshaitva Nijaraja Isvaro
Yudhishthiram Pritamana Babuvaha
Yudhishthiram Pritamana Babuvaha
Sutavacha
Sutavacha
Vamshankuro Vamshadavani Niritam
Vamsham kuro vamsharavagni niritam. Samrohaitva bhava bhava no hari. Nivesha itva nijaraja ishvaro. Yudhishthiram pritamana babuvaha. Sutovacha. Sutta Goswami replied. Vamsham dynasty. Kuro. O King Kuru. Vamshadavagni. A forest fire set by the bamboos. Niritam. Exhausted. Samrohahitva. Seedling of the dynasty. Bhava Bhavana. The maintainer of creation. Hari. The personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. Niveshayitva. Having re-established. Nijaraje. In his own kingdom. Ishvara. The Supreme Lord. Yudhishthiram. Antu Maharaj Yudhishthira. Pritamana. Pleased in his mind. Babuvaha. Became. Translation of the verse. Sutta Goswami said, Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the maintainer of the world, became pleased after re-establishing Maharaj Yudhishthira in his own kingdom and after restoring the Kuru dynasty, which had been exhausted by the bamboo fire of anger. Please repeat. Sutta Goswami said, Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead,
Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead,
who is the maintainer of the world,
who is the maintainer of the world,
became pleased after re-establishing Maharaj Yudhishthira,
became pleased after re-establishing Maharaj Yudhishthira,
in his own kingdom,
in his own kingdom,
and after restoring the Kuru dynasty,
and after restoring the Kuru dynasty,
which had been exhausted by the bamboo fire of anger,
which had been exhausted by the bamboo fire of anger.
Purport. This world is compared to a forest fire caused by the cohesion of bamboo bushes. Such a forest fire takes place automatically, for bamboo cohesion occurs without external cause. Similarly, in the material world, the wrath of those who want to lord it over material nature interacts, and the fire of war takes place, exhausting the unwanted population. Such fires or wars take place, and the Lord has nothing to do with them. But because he wants to maintain the creation, he desires the mass of people to follow the right path of self-realization, which enables the living beings to enter into the kingdom of God. The Lord wants the suffering human beings to come back home, back to him, and cease to suffer the threefold material pangs. The whole plan of creation is made in that way. A one who does not come to his senses suffers in the material world by pangs inflicted by the illusory energy of the Lord. The Lord, therefore, wants his bona fide representative to rule the world. Lord Sri Krishna descended to establish this sort of regime and to kill the unwanted persons who have nothing to do with his plan. The battle of Kurukshetra was fought according to the plan of the Lord, so that undesirable persons could get out of the world and a peaceful kingdom under his devotee could be established. The Lord was therefore fully satisfied when King Yudhishthira was on the throne and the seedling of the dynasty of Kuru in the person of Maharaj Parikshit was saved. Sutta uvacha vamsham kuror vamshadavagni niritam sarmoha hitva bhava bhavano hari nivesha itva nijaraja ishvaro yudhishthiram pritamana babhuvaha. Sutta Goswami said, Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the maintainer of the world, became pleased after he established Maharaj Yudhishthira in his own kingdom and after restoring the Kuru dynasty, which had been exhausted by the bamboo fire of anger. Om Jnanati Mirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Miritandyena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Sri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Stapitam Dhyana Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Uta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vashnavancha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitantam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Cha E Krishna Karuna Sindo Dinabando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurange Radha Vrinda Vanishvari Vrishabhano Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpataro Vyascha Kripa Sindhu Vyavacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadada Srivasa Adi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So Lord Sri Krishna was satisfied at the end of the whole ordeal because he accomplished what he wanted. One of the reasons of his coming in this world was that the demons should be rooted out of this planet and that his devotees were to manage the kingdoms of this world. So it was the so that's what he wanted and accomplished it by his own power and by the help or cooperation of the devotees. Krishna does not want to do things by himself. He wants his devotees to participate because this is the mood, the mentality in the spiritual world. If someone may ask, and actually if I don't remember incorrectly, some of you asked, or maybe somebody else or somewhere, I don't remember now, so why Krishna set up all this complicated thing, or the war, and all these things? He could have just killed everybody, you know, he's God, you know, he's all powerful. So why did he do that? Because this is not the way he acts, and this is not the mentality. This is a kind of Christian mentality, or nowadays Christian mentality, that God is Almighty, and you know, he punishes everyone, he kills everyone, and that's it. You know, so this is not the way he works. He was he wants his devotee to participate. This is how the spiritual world is. There is Krishna and there are the devotees, and both they are desires. And sometimes Krishna accepts the desires of his devotees. It's not that the Krishna is the only one desiring the devotees they performs, they do what he wants. This is not how the spiritual world is. Sometimes the Krishna wants his desire to be accomplished. Sometimes Krishna accepts his devotee's desire to, and he accomplishes it. So there is a great deal of freedom in the spiritual world, a great deal of auto initiative, personal initiative. And even in now in our movement, we want the devotees to have initiative, to do things. Of course, new devotees should first be trained, you know. But even during the training period, there are things which are obviously correct, that doesn't need somebody to tell somebody else, do this in this way. There are certain things which are obvious, which is elementary, and the devotee should feel free to exercise if his his will. So the new devotee should get trained up, and during the process of training, is the space, the room of his initiative should grow more and more. And one day, a devotee will be in the field of action of a relative full sense of initiative. Krishna wants to see us, what we do. Krishna wants to see what we do, how we do it. So he leaves us free to do certain things, and he watches us. We saw that Arjuna did not want to fight this battle, the Bhagavad Gita, the whole thing of the reason why the Bhagavad Gita was spoken was because Arjuna did not want to fight. Of course, there are very deep reasons why Krishna did not want to fight. He wanted Krishna to speak the Bhagavad Gita. Still, we saw that Krishna was free. And even during the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna at a certain point said to Arjuna, now I have spoken transcendental knowledge to you, now do what you want. It's not that he said, well, you know, I am the Supreme Personality of God, I am Almighty, so either you do what I want or I will throw you forever in hell. He didn't say that. He said, now you do what to consider and do what you want. This concept of the relationship within the Supreme Person, within God and his devotees is quite new, actually, in the history of religion. You don't find many other religions who has this conception of a relationship which is very personal and very intimate between a God and the devotee. Most of the conception of God, religions have this conception of God Almighty, and we should just obey, that's all. You know? And what?
It's inconceivable.
Yeah, it's, you cannot understand it, so you just do what he wants. So in other religions, and we have been studying, of course, all the religions, you see that what's going to happen in paradise or in heaven or in it's not clear how we are going to pass our eternity, because frankly, if an eternity should be just to obey to a God who is feared, and you live eternally with the fear of God, it's really scary, you know.
Yeah, that's like a good quality to have, the fear of God.
Yeah.
So
it's utterly scary, actually, to pass, because for some time we can accept it, but for the eternity, it's really something not many people want to do. Personally, I won't accept. At least here in this world, we have some room for action. While if in the spiritual world, in the supposed spiritual world, we don't have this type of freedom, of expression, of initiative, etc. Not many people would want to do that, want to live in that way. So the spiritual world must be an appealing place, must be a place where everybody wants to be, and so who wants to be in a place where you are not allowed to think and to do and to act? So this conception of the relationship between God and the spirit soul, every one of us, is quite original, is quite new. I never heard such a thing, that Krishna says to his devotee, okay, this is the truth, but you do what you want. You're not forced, you're not obliged, you're not. And this is beautiful. This is absolutely beautiful, because you can see the respect that God, even God, gives to his sons. He doesn't treat them as an objects. Either you do or you go to hell. And there is some respect, there is some understanding of the part of God that we need our space, that we need our freedom. Life and freedom must be together. You cannot live a life of slavery, psychological or physical slavery, that either you do what I want or I throw you in hell. And even this material world, you can see that it is not the comparison that sometimes has been done of this material world as a jail is not really really correct. It should be more compared to a re-educational place. You know, like in the world there are different types of jail. I was reading some time ago of some countries like Sweden or very civilized place, highly socially very very elevated places where you have jails without doors and without bars, you know, and it's more they have school and they kind of re-educate the person. And of course, it's not that someone who kills a lot of people, etc., should enjoy life in this place. This place, still you don't have a freedom, but the idea, the general idea, most of the people are in jail are for minor reasons. You know, they are not killed, they are not Charles Manson, you know. So in this way, you can see that God does not want us just to suffer here. He's not jealous. He's not a type of, okay, you don't want to love me, so you go to suffer. This is not what he wants. He said, well, the way he thinks is that you don't want to love me, but if you love me, you enjoy more. So I want you to love me, because you'll be happier, and I want you to be happy. So he sends us in a world where there is some enjoyment and some re-educational, re-educating suffering. And so especially in these planets, in this part of the universe, where suffering and enjoyment are quite balanced. So this conception, it's very beautiful, I find, and we should preach it to people. That a religion where God respects so much his creation, the creation of the personalities, that he leaves the persons free and even to enjoy if he wants, you know. And there are heavens where you can enjoy. You can enjoy millions of years. So God is not envious, saying, you don't want to love me and you are enjoying. No, you cannot enjoy. Just go to hell. Everyone, or either you come in the spiritual world or you go to hell. This is not this mentality. It's not envious. It's not jealous. It's not that kind of person. Sometimes you can see in human misery when you have a bad relationship with somebody, if you know that that somebody is having success, you really you really are hoping that it will crash, that it will fail. This is human misery. That is, God is not like, doesn't have this kind of of a degradation, degrading mentality. Everyone who doesn't agree with me must be a failure. So, but at the same time, it is a matter of fact that there is something that you just cannot have without him, because this is how the creation is made. So, even if in this world you can have some kind of enjoyment, still, in this world there are two problems which are just you cannot. There is a word in English, I don't remember now, this imprescindible, that it cannot be divided, and can help me? that you cannot separate from this place.
Unseparable?
Yeah, that's kind of inseparable. There is another word anyway. First of all, is the temporary nature, that in this world is just everything finished. So, what's the point of working so much for something you know that it's going to finish? I mean, this is the ABC, not of a very high philosophical concept. Any person who has some intelligence should understand this point, that one should work for the things which are real and real, and eternity is just it's the same thing. Reality and eternity are two qualities, so they're the same perfection. Perfection means eternity and reality. So it's but there is an even bigger problem. Someone may think that, well, you know, the bigger problem in this world is that it's temporary. No, it's not the main problem. The biggest problem is that the incompatibility of the material nature with the nature of the soul. In other words, what you enjoy is just not enough. It's not enough. Because someone can cope with the problem of temper. Okay, I know I'm going to live 100 years, 50 years, 60 years, but at least I'm going to enjoy. Then maybe righteously, then I'm going to worship some demigods, and then I'm going to take a nice bath, which is what is actually what's going to happen. You're going to take baths in the upper planets or in a very rich family here in this world. You're going to enjoy life after life after life. You study the Vedas, you can live in this world very happily, relatively happily, for millions of years, like this. Just following the Vedas, just reading the Vedas under a very expert guidance, and then do the sacrifice, the yagyas, you know, following the dharma of your specific family or situation, and then life after life, birth after birth after birth, you're going to enjoy some type of life. But it's like when a person is in a desert for a million of years, for so many years, and then you give him a drop of water. It's just not enough. You feel that it's not enough because you are spiritual. Then, since matter and spirit are incompatible, any type of enjoyment in this material world, you just feel that it's just not enough. It's not enough. It's just the idea of enjoyment. It's not the real enjoyment. It's like the ghost. A ghost is a body, a subtle body without a gross body. And the ghost enjoys some type of relationship with the objects of the senses, but since he doesn't have the body, he cannot really enjoy it. He's just enjoying it by thinking. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of masturbation, no? That you are enjoying, but actually you don't have anything. You're just enjoying the idea, the thought. So this is a ghostly situation in which someone enjoys just the idea. And then, from trying to enjoy something unreal, at the end there comes a deep frustration, because you need the real thing. So the spirit soul, trying to enjoy this world without a spiritual body, which is his body, but with another body incompatible in nature with the spirit soul, then what it does is to try to enjoy an idea, but not actually enjoying the real thing, because the real thing is a spiritual as much as spiritual is his body. So temporary, yes, it's a big problem, it's a misery, you know, everything you do, but this incompatibility that we find, that we experience with the relationship with the enjoyable, so-called enjoyable things in this material world is the main problem and the main thing that will push us, hopefully, very soon towards pure devotion to Radha and Krishna. So, this is something that I understood from this verse, very beautiful verse, like everyone, of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And the spiritual life is based on certain principles, and we have to know these principles, the positive things that we have to do to improve our spiritual life. Chanting Hare Krishna is one, and study the scriptures is another one, and following the days, holy days like Ekadashi, this is very important also, and accepting a guru is another principle, and another very important principle is to live in a holy place, you know, like a temple, or transforming his own house in a temple, or going to the holy places like Vrindavan and Mayapur. This is very important. It's very important. An association with devotees is also exceedingly important, maybe the most important of all. Because when you associate with devotees, you find everywhere, all of this. The devotees is a holy place in himself, and of course when you start with a devotee, you always hear about Krishna and Krishna's pastimes and descriptions, what he says, what he does. So it is important that the temple is a place where the four regulative principles are followed in chanting Hare Krishna. If in a temple four regulative principles are not strictly observed, then it's not a temple. The atmosphere will, you just feel that something is wrong. So this is very important. Four regulative principles and chanting Hare Krishna, studying of the scriptures, this is exceedingly important. Going to holy places like Vrindavan also is very important, and we should, as soon as possible, as soon as we should go and visit Vrindavan and Mayapur. And going to Vrindavan, we should not go to see the places. I remember the first time that I went to Vrindavan, my temple president would tell me, since I was very curious as a young, still I'm curious, I was looking around, you know. So the temple president told me, we are not here for sightseeing. Well, of course, you go to Vrindavan, you have to see the places. I hope this is, he didn't mean that we should not look at places. But what it is actually true about this, that we should go in a holy place with somebody who knows the places. It is called a Tirtha Guru, someone who can teach you. Krishna did this in this place, I can teach you how to do, and also how to approach the holy place. Because doing offenses to the holy places are very easy. It's very easy. Extremely easy. Now we have to be very careful, especially to the inhabitants. As soon as you go there and you find thousands of people asking you money, bothering, you have been to India, yeah? So there are, and it's very hot, it's very dirty sometimes in Vrindavan and all these things. You had to go there with somebody who can instruct you how to go, stay in a holy place and take the best from the holy place. important is to know the holy place also. How, where are the places where Krishna? This is why Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu sent his disciples there to excavate, to recover the holy places in such a way when we go there, we can meditate. But if we don't know what happened in this place, then we just pass by. You know, there was one, I was, remember one time in Radhakunda with my god brother of mine who lived in Radhakunda. So there was some kind, it wasn't a lake, it was kind of it looked like a damp place, you know, with some water or something. You know, since there was some water, I said to him, oh, what is this kunda? And he said, oh no, it's not a kunda, it's a sewage. You know, because there was a lot of things and the water didn't look very, very, very. Oh, then I asked to another devotee who is probably more expert, oh no, but that is such an, I don't know, that is called a Shiva core or something. They were Lord Shiva. Then it was an extremely holy place. So he just didn't know. So every day he would go by this place and think, oh, this is a sewage when it was a very important holy place. So we had to know. So if we should not go on vacation in the holy place, we should go there to study the holy dam, the Shri Dam, so that we can get a lot of benefit in this. Okay, so if there is any question, this time I think I have this small microphone here, and I think if you have, you had to come here and take it, otherwise. Right. See, we are talking about thousands of people listening to these classes. That's why I know sometimes it looks bad that I record my own classes, you know. But it's just that so many people ask, you know, and they listen. I mean, they're talking about 1,200, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's very nice to know that more people are listening.
My question is from the it's from the purport. Thank you very much. Actually, that was very illuminating in regards to the desire, or Krishna's desire, and his how he wants to see us and how he treats us with full freedom and total respect of whatever you like. I'll share with you. My question is, the other side of Krishna's more firm hand, and says here, removing according to the plan of the Lord, so that undesirable persons could get out of the world and a peaceful kingdom under his devotee could be established, which includes killing or removing. And yesterday we were listening to that class of Srila Prabhupada's class on the first verse of this chapter, where he talks about killing and how, you know, about four types of aggressors who come here. They should, when somebody comes, like, they should immediately be killed. And it sounds very sounds very heavy, that I kind of wanted to kind of explain a little bit what that means. But could you speak a little bit more on that? When, and is it really always necessary to kill the aggressor? Can violence be kind of buffered down or minimized to as much as necessary? And not necessarily kill the person when it comes. I can actually get to the exact quote.
No, I know. I know this. Prabhupada said that many times. It's not, well, not many times, but he said it several times, so it has to be understood. The perspective must be understood. Otherwise, we misunderstand. So, first of all, what is the role of the acharya? Srila Prabhupada wasn't just a guru. Prabhupada was the acharya. He came in a place where nobody knew anything, just anything. So he had to reestablish from the very roots the basics of the culture and tell us things that maybe that do not they often do not apply at all to us. But he had to tell us, just like when we give initiations, we know that some will not maintain the vote, the oath that they do during initiations. So the initiating spiritual master knows that, and sometimes he may even understand who is most probably is not going to. You know. So still, he gives initiation because this is his role. So the acharya is someone who establishes effects, and then these effects must be applied according to time and circumstance. His Prabhupada told us things which are totally impossible for us to understand and to practice. But he had to tell us. I remember a few months ago, there was when I was in Italy, there is this Bhaktin, very nice devotee actually. And she asked me about the regular principles, and she said, well, you know, I'm not able to follow all the rules and regulations. And many devotees, initiated devotees, do not also do that. So why do you give rules that you know that some people, or many people, we will say, will not follow? Well, the answer is that they cannot follow even if you ask them what to think if you don't ask them. Mm. At least you have to tell them the perfection, where they had to arrive. But if you don't tell them, that they will never arrive there. So this answer was quite convincing to her, and so she's now trying to follow better, etc., etc. During other ages, like Dwapara Yuga or Treta Yuga or Satya Yuga, there were really no reasons for being violent. Someone who was violent in those ages was really a demon. And there was nothing you could do. It was a little thing that you could do other than to reply with violence. So that's why the rule, there are certain rule of the Vedas. You find, like, for instance, Lord Ramachandra in Ramayana, one time he found a Shudra. He was studying and reciting the Vedas. So he killed him right on the spot. We were in Treta Yuga. So would you kill somebody here in San Antonio because you find him studying the Vedas or reciting the Gayatri Mantra without being initiated? Of course you don't. Of course you don't. Why? Because we are in Kali Yuga. In Kali Yuga there are no big demons. You know, everyone is a little bit rascal, a little bit good people, you know. Everyone can understand, everyone can talk. Even if someone attacks you, you know, most of the time you solve the problem just by talking, you know. Or just by going away, you know, just running away or something. You don't really need to kill anybody here, because now we are... But you had to know that this is a rule, because we had to know our culture. It's like in the past, there were devotees who would tell me, in our young age, we are talking about 35, 40 years ago, in our young age, there were some devotees, like myself and others, you know, who loved to study more than others. So the physical, fully passionate devotees going in sankirtan or coming back to a temple and finding somebody, you know, reading was really a little bit annoying to them, because we were at the time that we had to push our movement, we had to create from zero our movement, just like you are doing here in San Antonio, but you are not starting from zero. At least you have the books, you have other temples, you have sannyasis, you have gurus, you have proper disciples, and you have so many things. We had nothing. We didn't have books. We didn't have books. We didn't know what Prabhupada was telling us, especially in other countries. We didn't even understand what Prabhupada was telling us. At least you can listen to Prabhupada classes. So we didn't have Prabhupada classes at that time. So the studying is necessary, and also the sankirtan and the service is necessary. And we had to know our culture if we want to represent it. So there are certain things which are not applicable to us, but we had to know them just as a point of reference for us. Because if we tell them, for instance, that we are against, for instance, if somebody would tell us, are you in favor of a death penalty? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Death penalty. Are you in favor of death penalty? I always say I'm against. You know? And then, you know, that same person reads the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna wanted to kill everybody. You know, and that Lord Ramachandra, as I said the story, and you know, finding the Shiva Bhagavatam, that Maharaj Parikshit was killing Kali, wanted to kill Kali, and that the death penalty was something very normal during the Vedic times.
Yeah.
So why do we say that we are against the death penalty? We are against that penalty because the times are changed. It's not the same thing. You don't treat the same. This is, I always used to say, that this philosophy for intelligent people. You don't hear something, you do it. You just do it. You know, you have to understand when to apply this thing that you have heard. Of course, if somebody tells you, do this, you do that. But if you hear an instruction, you have to understand how and when to apply it. And we have the Bhagavad Gita. If an aggressor, if someone attacks you, you have to kill him. But this is not the only instruction. First, Srila Prabhupada explained that you should convince the person. And second, you should try to win his heart. And then you talk, and then you go away, and then... But today, it's very, very hard to find a situation where you have to kill somebody. It's very hard. We are against all violence. Vedic, we had to know Vedic culture. We had to know how to apply Vedic culture. Just like when Jagai and Madai was attacking Lord Nityananda Prabhu, and actually they hit him. He was bleeding. You know? So Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wanted to kill them. And Nityananda said, no, you didn't come here to kill people like in your previous incarnations. You came here to kill the demonic mentality. So we are against all violence, and we are against all everything that needs attacking physically people, and this should be kept only at the end, where just there is nothing you can do, and then you have to resort to violence. In my life, I never encountered such a situation. I know the Sun devotees did. I know quite a few stories. You know, like there was a gang of people attacking our temple and shooting people. They were threw bombs against the devotees. You know the sannyasi, Bhakti Raghava's family, with only one leg. So he had, I was told this story, he already had an offended leg, you know. And so during this attack, one of those bandits, they threw a bomb, and the bomb exploded near him, and it took away his leg, but only the already offended leg. It was just, boom, all the way. So that is a case where violence is you have to do something. You cannot just wait for somebody to shoot you. But apart from this, there is no any questions?
No.
Please come closer. Maybe you can just sit here, you know, if we are going to talk for some minutes more.
Yeah. Thank you. So, you're talking about Vedic times, how, you know, violence seemed to be more prominent in the Vedic times. I don't know. I guess I would just like more clarification about that. Like, why is nonviolence something that we should practice more in the darker times?
No, during many times there was less violence. The little violence that there was there was a big violence by big demons, or between kshatriyas, that they love to fight against each other. But the so-called Vedic times were a time of a lot of peace. Today there is a small violence. Everybody's fighting, everyone is arguing. There was no such a thing during Vedic, in other ages. You can see every family there is a small fighting and people yelling, and the husband yelling to the wife, and the wife yelling to the kids. Isn't that?
Age of quarreling in the
pockets. Age of quarreling. And everybody's fighting and arguing, and everybody. But it's a small thing. During the very times, there was no such a thing, but from time to time, a big demon, such bad king would come out, you know, like that. But there was a lot of peace between people, because their mind was political people, and in sports, and everybody's fighting against something or someone. You know. You just feel it in the atmosphere, and even everybody, isn't that? A lot of criticism, even in our movement. But this is Kali Yuga. The Kali Yuga is the moment where there is a pleasure in arguing and criticizing. It's a pleasure. You see a devotee who is doing admirable service, etc., and you're talking about these devotees, you start saying, oh yes, he's doing, but, why the but, you know, just forget it about it. You see what I mean? And you will spend 30 seconds talking about the glories of this person and 10 minutes talking about the butts. This is Kali Yuga. It's just, why? Because it's not so pleasant to glorify someone else in Kali Yuga. Very few people find pleasure in glorification because the ego, because it's a problem of ego. Glorifying someone else, one is worried that I may be slighted, I may be not in the center. And this is a psychological problem that almost everybody has. Or I should say, most of the people as. The advancement of the devotee is also measured by how much he likes to glorify Krishna, of course, but also the devotees. During Srila Prabhupada times, for instance, criticism was completely prohibited. In the temple, if you would say something, all the devotees would shut you up. Shh! Well, this is prohibited. You cannot talk about that, you know. And if you had something to say, you just go to the temple president and you say, look, Prabhu, you know, I saw this and that, you know. And then he would take care. But there was no public talking about anything, just service and study of the Shastras and like this. It was a very beautiful atmosphere, extremely, extremely positive. And the temple president, who was a kind of a dump place where everybody would go dumping all the garbage, and he would take care. And the devotees, nowadays everybody wants to be a president. At that time nobody wanted to be a president because it was the lowest of the position, because he had to deal with material things, let's say, with miseries. Everybody at that time wanted to be a pot washer. There was a mentality. Mm-hmm. It was the best service, was the service that was as pure. It didn't bring you in contact with management, with money, with problems, with devotees, you know, these kind of things. There was a mentality. We were very young, we were 20 years old, but I remember the devotee arguing who would clean the bathroom. I want to clean the bathroom, because it was the lowest. Then it was very, actually, this mentality is very good in spiritual life. One should desire simple service, very humble service, so that your mind is free. You don't have to think to anything but the service, and during the service you can just think about Krishna's pastimes and study shlokas and these kind of things. This is a very nice spiritual life. Anything else?
I don't remember. Well, I want to comment, you know, about you saying in the Prabhupada's days there was no criticizing or things like that. You know, it was a very positive atmosphere. I remember hearing, this was when I first started coming to the temple. I don't remember who I heard it from, but it was a devotee saying that. And this was after Prabhupada's times, and I'm pretty sure they were talking about an ISKCON temple. I think they were saying that there was a practice in the temple where everybody, all the devotees would gather, and they would all take turns. Everybody would say something they liked about somebody, and then say something that they didn't like, you know. And have you ever heard of that practice? Or?
There was a practice practiced in some temples, not everywhere. And after Prabhupada's disappearance, somebody speculated that it was a nice thing to do, to keep humble the devotees, etc. But this is a very bad, this is a total speculation. Prabhupada never told us to do that. It's a horrible thing to do, to criticize or to say something bad about somebody else, and even to say something good about in front of everybody like this. We should be very sober and not to do these kind of things that looks like more like emotional things. We should not unleash emotions in others. And if you over-glorify somebody, it will just become something really ridiculous, you know, because everybody knows that it's not true. You're not going to say, oh, this devotee, you know, I remember at that time there was somebody saying, oh, the devotee, I saw him with four hands, you know. Like, he's so pure, I saw him. This is... there should be some... some soberness in the way we... So, and we should have a sober respect for everybody, no matter who. And this kind of appreciation should be according to the type of devotees. Temple president should be very much respected because he's the one who is leading the temple. And then we have the sannyasis, and then we have the brahmanas, and then we have the initiated devotees, and then we have the gurus, and then we have the GBCs. We had to learn how to deal with everybody. For instance, you had a very nice devotee, a lady devotee in these days here, Mataji Vishaka, was very dear to Srila Prabhupada. I received personal instructions from Srila Prabhupada. He told her and her husband to do a specific service. And I don't know how much Yadavar Prabhu is still doing it, maybe not. I don't know what he's doing. I know that she is still taking photographs and doing this kind of things. This is a service that Srila Prabhupada personally told her to do. So we had to understand that there should be some respect. But it's so nice to, it's just we had to know how to respect. The respect should not be exaggerated, nor there should be it should be less than it is due. We had to learn Vaishnava etiquettes. In the beginning, we may, like we were in the beginning of the movement, respecting devotees in a way that maybe we should not. So now, with time, we understand how to balance or to do the right thing. So this is a... this is a science, actually, because it involves personal psychology and interaction with the public. You know, like, for instance, when Srila Prabhupada was coming, I was arriving in the airport, so we were going there and doing big, huge kirtans, and then bowing down, there were thousands of people looking at us, you know. And some people would think that we are crazy. And so now we had to, when the guru arrives, of course, we had to pay obeisance. Maybe we should, I'm saying, not necessarily this is not an instruction that I'm giving, it's just that maybe in the airport we can just do the obeisances like this, you know, in the paying, doing the dandavas just in your heart. And when you go to the temple, you do the dandavas physically. You know, maybe it's not necessary, maybe we should do it in the airport, or maybe not. It's just a question of understanding how to do and the way. And also, 20 years old boy, people understand that he's young, he's enthusiastic, but if you are 50, 60, people say, why a 50 years old man is bowing down on the floor in the airport, when the guru comes, it's a different thing. 30 years ago, 35, or 40 years ago, was different. It was a hippie revolution, and seeing something strange was normal. Mm. While today, if you see something like that, times have changed, and we have to understand that times have changed. We cannot do the same things. Again, this is a philosophy for intelligent people. We have to understand how to apply it without compromising with our principles, but again, without compromising, we have to do it in a certain way according to time and circumstances. This is called Kala Desha Patra. Kala, time, Desha, place, and Patra, circumstances.
I thank you very much.
I
just heard recently that, I don't know if you can recall, if there is such a quote describing, you know how they say in previous ages, demoniac and divine were in different planets. Then in Treta Yuga, on the same planet. Then Dvapara Yuga, same family. And then in Kali Yuga, in the same person, we find both of these qualities. Do you have? I just heard, it was a devotee just came from India, he said that there's no quote that confirms that ever in Shastra the Prabhupada ever said that in one person there's actually, we find both. There's no quote like that, so just out of your, you know, many years of experience, have you heard, I mean, have you ever used that in your preaching as something that is factual, or...
I cannot recall, but it's a fact, having read in proper books or hearing Srila Prabhupada saying that. This is a fact. We had a discussion one time about this point, I remember, and one devotee said, no, I read it somewhere in Prabhupada books. Well, now we have a folio, which is a great tool, so we can do a research. Well, we remember, for instance, the Hiranyakashipu, he lived in Satya Yuga. You know, Prahlad Maharaj was his son.
Satya Yuga?
Yeah, Hiranyakashipu, up in Satya Yuga. It was his son, same family, but it may be just a, you know,
exception.
We should research about this. I cannot give you any quote, and I don't remember having read it somewhere.
I mean, we do hear from Gita, we have a higher and lower natures.
Oh, there is no doubt. Well, there is no doubt. You can see it in our movement, because we live together. We spend so much time, we deal with each other very much time. You can see it. You can see how sometimes a negative nature comes up for nothing. You know, it is enough that you are a little tired and someone tells you something and you just yell at him. We have a time sometimes to control our mind. Actually, if someone is... if someone is strong spiritually, the body and the mind should be kind of less connected. If something happens to your body, you should still be able to control your mind, your emotions. So, if you are sick, you will see with Srila Prabhupada, he was tremendously sick. But he was always the same, the way he was speaking and the way what he was saying up to the last moment of his life in this planet. He was in a deathbed, and his doctors would say that any normal man would be screaming and crying out of pain, because he had a very, very painful disease. But he was talking, you can read, on the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and what he was saying. You know, this deathbed, any man would be just unable to think or to speak. So like Bhishmadeva, because we read, you know, the Bhishmadeva says about Sri Krishna, etc. But he had hundreds of arrows in his body. Sometimes we forget how much pain it should be there just to be pierced by something, you know. And he was not touching the floor for so many arrows. It must be an extremely painful situation. But he spoke the Shantiparva in this situation. The Shantiparva is a huge chapter of the Mahabharata, and you had to read it to understand who Bhishmadeva was. He was an encyclopedia of knowledge he could speak about anything, and he could recall stories, and he was obviously a superhuman person. So the question is, no, I didn't recall reading it. During Prabhupada times, so there was a lot of Prabhupada said that had never been said, you know. We could have written a book on the thing that Prabhupada said that actually never said. But we can make some research and see if there is some Shastri base in this statement.
That would be a really good book. Prabhupada said, quote unquote.
Yes. I like.
As a comical release.
Like, yeah.
The garbanzo beans or something like that.
Yeah, the seven. Like. Eating the seven chickpeas. The Prabhupada said that that Brahmachari should only eat seven chickpeas a day. That was good. Oh, you know, but there were a lot of things. Not all things that Prabhupada said has been recorded. You know, I was with Srila Prabhupada 7 days. And in these 7 days, you know, he was saying a lot of things. There was no microphone anywhere. He was just speaking. There was no record of it, you know. A small conversation he had. Sometimes I heard of quite philosophy. You know, he was talking to people and the devotees. Sometimes giving advices to devotees. And there was no recording. So maybe this devotee heard something from Srila Prabhupada that Srila Prabhupada actually said. But there is no evidence anywhere. So we should take as absolute truth actually only what is written in the books. And even in his conversation, sometimes he will say something to a devotee without meaning to be an instruction for everybody. Like Srila Prabhupada would say, no, you don't get married. So I remember that there was this thing that everywhere in our movement, somebody sent a letter, said, oh, Prabhupada said that nobody should get married anymore in our movement, you know. But he was saying that to that devotee. Or no, you should get married, so that everybody should get married. You know, young age does these things, you know.
Now that you're mentioning that, in regards to this class, yesterday we were listening about Prabhupada. I think he gave that class when he talks about killing, and I think it was class from Mayapur. And I'm going to check the date to see if that, you know, that's matching, you know, the difficulties that our projects had in Mayapur. So it could be like commentary and just, you know, kind of reinforcing the faith in devotees that they should protect the you know, Krishna's facility. Because being under attack, you know, self-defense, one does whatever is necessary, you know.
When you use violence, you have to be ready to receive more violence. So and then you have to react to violence. It's a spiral. You can say that it's a spiral. In a spiral, it's a chain. Sometimes unbreakable of action and reactions. So basically, what we should do is to win the heart of people, and only. To those people who do not respond to violence or violence, then there is no other, there are no reactions, because you didn't answer with violence. If you do, then you want revenge, and you have to respond more revenge, etc. So our movement, we have no kshatriyas, we have nor we have the right to have them. We don't have the right, according to the state, to the laws of the majority of the states where we are, we cannot be armed. so we cannot. Our movement is for brahmanas. It's not for kshatriyas.
In Texas, you can carry the arms. You can be licensed carrying.
Yes, you can have a handgun permit.
You can if you have a gun, then you have to be ready to use it. And most criminals, they have gun also, because they know that you have the gun. So if you don't have the gun, they don't need the gun, and they come with a stick or with a knife, and they will tell you, give me the money. But because they know you have the gun, they are ready any second to shoot you. So having the gun is not a good response to violence. It's even worse, actually.
Well, it's like, you know, after World War II, you know, it was like, well, you have atomic bombs, so yes. I should have atomic bombs too.
Yes. Yes. Only violence should be used only in the extreme situation. Then violence should be used by us, but it should be really at the end of the end. We should be very peaceful. And I saw in my experience is most of the people who are violent, even verbally, you know, enemies, our movement, we got a lot of them, and people come into the temple and disagreeing with us, and sometimes they argue with us. If you respond to them with violence, this is what they are waiting for. Because you are throwing fuel in the fire. And they will. But if you are very humble, they are very humble and very respectful, they will continue to attack you. But after some time, that they must cool down. Because, you see, unless it is a real demon, it's with a heart like a stone, you cannot really argue with a person, with a humble person. Isn't that?
Yeah.
You know? But if you say, what? And immediately it will kind of listen. It's fire. So we should be very humble, just like Lord Nityananda Prabhu. He won over Jagannath Madai's heart by his humbleness. They were scared of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but the one who won their heart was Nityananda, because Nityananda was very humble. He said, oh, okay, you hit me, it's not a problem, just chant Hare Krishna, this is all I want. Not only they became devotees, they became acharyas, they had disciples. They were murderers. They were the worst kind of person that you can imagine. So I think this is the best way of dealing with the with humbleness and tolerance. This is the best.
Kill them with kindness.
Yes, yes, yes. You cut at the root the aggressivity if you are humble and simple. And this is also the Brahminical. We should be Brahmanas. And the Brahmanas doesn't have aggressivity. Aggressivity is correct? Aggressivity. The Brahmanas should be very learned and tolerant and humble and simple. This is a Brahmana. We should be Brahmanas in this moment. Anything more?
No, I'm having another segue. I mean, it's actually not a question; it's a comment. So, if you want to
close,
if you want,
if you want to make a comment,
it's well, yeah, it's a segue. As you mentioned about the Brahmanas and what Prabhupada gave us, the society of Brahmanas, the culture, Brahminical culture, and the quality of that is that. It's a non-violent, it's a culture of education and knowledge. And non-violence is kind of part of it. So this whole
there's a worldwide movement of, you know, nonviolent civil disobedience in the form of Occupy and other movements like that. One, it seems like it's a kind of a social, the social gathering of people with that are intellectuals with brahminical qualities coming, crying out for what Prabhupada actually gave us, the depth of brahminical culture or the substance. And we see that, you know, when we actually do get in contact with these people, they're actually very, very bright and very deep people. So it's actually, you know, the social unrest has kind of floated those individuals on top, and we can actually just come and scoop them up and give them some substance with Prabhupada's message. Because they are actually very brahminically inclined.
If we go to people with a bright face and with happy eyes, you know, just chanting and dancing and give them the highest philosophy, we will win them over. And if there is somebody who argue against, oh, you did this in the past, all the scandals, some scandal in the States that there was, you know, it's not in our philosophy. This is something that is the responsibility of the nonsense who did that. You know, what I have to do with that? I didn't do anything like that. We have to make them understand that our movement is pure. If there is something wrong, there is the fault of the individual. It's not the fault of the movement. There is what is in our scriptures and the teachings of our acharya. Unspeakable sins that has been done, or supposedly done in our movement is not. Or we have to go there with purity and smiling and simplicity, and people will be attracted. Nobody wants to come in a how you call it, a soldier play, where there are the soldiers, in a military house.
No, the
people don't want that. People want to come in a place where there is a lot of chanting and delicious prasadam. It's very important, and a lot of philosophy and studying, a lot of doing, a lot of activity. They should be there, especially young people. You cannot, you know, have them sit down and study the whole day long. And then, if we do that, there is no doubt that our temples, and specifically here in San Antonio, because there is you are doing this, I am totally admired by your work, what you are doing, and really, yesterday I started again doing the videos, you know, I spoke something about you, the way, the wonderful work you are doing here in San Antonio, and there is no doubt that this temple will flourish with so many devotees and things if you continue going out and preaching and reaching out to people with the simplicity and purity that you have. So this is the secret. Okay, thank you very much, Hare Krishna.